It's a great pleasure to see so many of you here tonight. And before I introduce our distinguished speaker, I'll give you a commercial announcement on behalf of the Vancouver Institute. The Institute's been going for nearly 100 years, since 1915 when the university was founded. Depends entirely on contributions from members, and we welcome anybody who would like to become a member. There is someone at the desk outside, happy to take your money. You get a tax receipt for the full amount. There are various categories of memberships if you're really feeling generous or have just won the lottery. Our major purpose is to bring distinguished speakers from around the world to UBC every Saturday night at 8:15. And we have had people like the Dalai Lama, Yusuf Karsh, Pierre Burton, Margaret Atwood, various distinguished figures from all the areas of the arts and the sciences in the world. But our speaker tonight is one of the few architects that we have been able to entice to the Institute. Hardly needs an introduction, but I thought I would just say a few words to justify my presence up here. I remember going to Montreal in 1967 to Expo and seeing Habitat, and could hardly believe that it had been designed by a man who was just 2 years older than I was, a graduate student then. And I don't think there are many students in the world that have their MA thesis turned into a world-famous building like Habitat, which is, of course, still a prominent feature on the waterfront in Montreal. Moshe Safdi was born in Haifa when it was still a British-mandated area, came to Montreal in 1953 with his family, finished school there, went to McGill, became an architect, studied or apprenticed with Louis Kahn down in Philadelphia afterward, and began a series of more than 30 buildings around the world. We in Vancouver, of course, know him from the public library, Library Square, a very distinctive building that perhaps is the most iconic building in Vancouver. My students are always writing papers comparing it to the Colosseum. But few people know that he also designed the building across the street, the Center for the Performing Arts. He has designed the National Art Gallery in Ottawa, the Old City Hall in Ottawa. He's done several buildings besides Habitat in Montreal. He has done the Sikh Cultural Center in Chandigarh in India. He's done a casino and a resort in Singapore. He has done an endless variety of structures around the world. He was even involved in the great Super Collider project, Waukehachie, in Texas. Worked on it for 3 years until the U.S. government canceled it because of the cost. The great Hadron Collider, the one that's about to go into operation in Switzerland now. He speaks all over the world, and I think perhaps best to sum up his philosophy are the closing lines of a poem that he wrote several years ago. Through the nature of the universe and the nature of man, we shall seek truth. If we seek truth, we shall find beauty. Ladies and gentlemen, Moshe Safdi.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here speaking on the inaugural memorial lecture for Arthur Erickson. Arthur was both a dear friend and a mentor. I recall vividly coming here in 1966. By then, I had designed Habitat, and it was about to be built, and the controversies about whether it'll stand up or collapse were raging. And Arthur received me here with great generosity, a party at his house, all the things that one does to endorse a young architect. And I guess people started thinking maybe the building will not collapse now that Arthur is friendly to it. In 1973, double images, I hope that works for you, but we were only one group in China. In 1973, Arthur, Francisco Crepas, my first wife, and I traveled to China. We actually spent 2 months together. We met in what was then Leningrad, took the Trans-Siberian, and met with Pierre Trudeau in Beijing when the diplomatic relationship was open. And I thought you'd be pleased to see this image. I did something wrong. I wanted the laser, but now I have nothing to point to. Okay. So, there is Arthur, and there's Francisco, and that's me with the black hair, and there's Nina, and that is the Institute of Art. Yeah, but this one needs a special person just pressing the button from the back. maybe I'll succeed. The Institute of Architects of Beijing. We spent a month traveling China. And we became very close. I want to talk about those particular qualities in Arthur's work, the central themes, which to me were a great influence. The first is his obsession with gardens, or I guess I would call it garden as metaphor, a kind of a sense that every building is an opportunity for creating a garden. The second is that Arthur was obsessed with creating a sense of place, and at two levels, that a place for community, for people, as he saw it, was an ennobling act, and also that he was a real student of culture. He traveled the world trying to understand the specificity of place. And finally, there was something about his work which celebrated the ritual of life, something that the modern movement had kind of all but forgotten, and a great preoccupation with symbols, symbolism. When I think of Simon Fraser, I think of that sense of the ritual of public life. And to use some of his own words, we seem today to have lost sight of the original goal of architecture, that is, to ennoble the place and the people who use it. It is a gift we have as architects to be able to do that. And talking about landscape, and here is the court with Cornelia's gardens. The city is a man-made landscape representing in topography, form, and even climate an ecological interdependence as delicate as nature. Every change in that structure can be felt throughout. It's like a tremor through the spider's web. And I think Arthur also had that sense of the symbolic significance of architecture and how to create meaningful symbols. Before I venture to talk about my work, I would like to relate all of that to the context of where architecture is today in relationship to these concepts and thoughts that I think pervaded his work. I think that there are two readings of where architecture is today. The first one is that architecture is flowering in our culture as it never did before. It is in all the media. It is a hot subject. We as a profession are getting more attention than ever before, it seems. And with it come a lot of themes, equating architecture to the other arts, to the visual arts, the performing arts. There are new terminologies Signature architecture. I hate the term, but there it is. Star architects. Architecture is considered to be an expressive and subjective art. I think Philip Johnson, who I think of as the great corrupter of our profession in the 20th century, summed it all up when he said, "There are no rules, no rights, no wrongs in any of the arts or architecture today, only the world of wonderful freedom." Freedom meaning no constraints. Architecture is not about constraints in that construct. And if you want to relate it to the broader culture, it has to do with branding, it has to do with advertising, it has to do with the commercial forces we live in. And I think above all, to the era, which I think we're emerging from, that the market knows best. And architecture is part of the marketplace. In fact, there's an irony that developers today hire star architects because it's good business. It's a good way to merchandise buildings. I've even noticed that there's an Ericsson building in town. And that shows you the power of branding. But as Octavio Paz said so eloquently some years ago, the market is blind and deaf. It is not fond of literature. It does not know how to choose. Its censorship is not ideological. It has no ideas. It knows all about prices, but nothing about values. Now, the other side, or the other picture of the profession, is that we are in a state of crisis, that things are not so good, that we are in the midst of radical change, and perhaps with it also opportunity. I think we all know how global warming has become a household term, that there's a sense that we have limits on how we deploy resources and energy on this planet. There's a sense today that automobile-dependent cities have reached their functional limits. There is consensus about the significance of sustainability. And there is also a sense, an understanding, that the demographics, the growing populations, the urbanization are creating a new kind of scale that we've never had to deal with before. And in that context, coming back to things that Arthur Erickson believed in very deeply, comes up the question of, is there an ethic to architecture? And you would think that that's sort of a self-answering question. Not at all. Actually, a very controversial subject. Because many believe that there are no ways of defining right or wrong, and that there is no ethical framework to architecture. Well, I believe that we must reaffirm that there is an ethic to architecture. It is a complex ethic. It has to do with how we use resources, materials. Do we create buildings which are inherently buildable, which have a profound sense of economy in the way they respond to the environment? And I don't mean by economy utility, and I mean an economy of achieving the most for the least. To what extent does a building resonate with its program? I'd like to use a term, life intended in a building. In what way does a building celebrate the life intended in a building? In what way does a building respond to its particular location, to its particular culture in this age of globalization, where everything is becoming increasingly the same? And finally, how do we contend with the issue of the day, which is a new one, the dehumanizing force of megascale? So, if I could... Should we dim the lights a little bit? How are the images? You want to try dimming? Is that better? So I go back to the China trip, and this is Beijing in 1973. In fact, I took that photograph with Arthur next to me. Beijing did not have a single high-rise building in 1973. We also went to Shanghai. Except for the Bund buildings from the beginning of the 20th century, not a single high-rise building. Now, I was back a few years ago, and Shanghai had several layers of high-rise buildings, triply stacked expressways, and all this happened in our lifetime. I mean, in 25 years. And understanding the force of urbanization and understanding the scale, the mega scale of cities, is to be appreciated most dramatically in China and in Asia generally. But this takes us back to some theoretical underpinnings. I think these two images represent the kind of two schools or two root concepts that emerged in the 20th century in response to urbanization. On the left is Hilversheimer's Ideal City of 1923. I emphasize his title, Ideal City, a concept of how to deal with the new emerging automobile in the city and high-rise construction. And on the right is the reaction to the emerging city, Ebenezer Howard's diagram for a garden city. And I think that we were, at least I was always, torn between this notion that there's a brave new world where everybody's equal. I guess that's what's the driving force here. And that we solve transportation problems by creating this new kind of urbanism. And the kind of translation that occurred, I admit that that's one of the more banal interpretations of it. But there it was, project after project, city after city, post-war rebuilding, public housing, etc. And with the garden city concept, the American suburbia and Levittown's et al. Forever going on. Nothing sums it up more beautifully than I think this diagram where we sacrificed 19th century urbanism for this new arrangement. If I was going back to Habitat in 67, I would say that what precipitated Habitat was the notion that we should merge these two concepts, the garden city and the new high-rise, high-density city. And if we could reinvent building types that provided the qualities of the house and the garden in a dense urban environment, somehow everything would come together. Nobody will want to live in suburbs again, etc., etc. We could build economic buildings by prefabricating them, and everybody would live happily ever after. Well, at least the residents of Habitat are living there happily ever after. The building, as some of you might know, was designated as a heritage building by the government of Quebec last year. And one is at least pleased to see that the quality of life, the notion of community and privacy that was envisaged there, is alive and well in that building 40 years later. Last year, as part of a series of fellowships that we've created in my office to do basic research work, we decided to revisit Habitat and see how would we do it today. So at the end of the year, with two fellows at work and the model shop helping them, there were about 100 models. You see some of them here. But we realized rapidly that there isn't a single response, that if you go back and say, how would we rethink Habitat, you could have many takes on it. The first was, everybody likes the environment that it offers, but can we make it more affordable? Can we make it easier to build? And so this first take on it replaces the complicated structure of cantilevered boxes by a very simple vertical structure, nevertheless trying to achieve streets in the air, gardens in the sky, as you see here, but at the fraction of the cost, so we hope, with the various gardens cantilevering in and out, but it's a very simple structure. Another take was to say, could we build it so much more efficiently so that these kind of membranes of hillsides of housing could be built with less effort and less complexity? And this led to these series of inclined structures, which, as you can see, are much more efficient structurally than the original conception with much greater densities. And A gets denser and denser. And then finally, the question was, could habitat, one of the criticisms was, well, it's not really that high a density. Could you be doing it at the density that you get in downtown Hong Kong or Manhattan? And so we took several blocks of downtown Manhattan with apartment buildings and office buildings and some retail on them, and we maintained the same density by reconfiguring it into a new arrangement of mixed-use offices and apartments and retail at street level. And it took us 60 floors up, 65 actually, 70, and opening it up in an airy way, lower structures being offices and above housing, many of which have roof gardens and public gardens and communal gardens and so on and so forth. Some of this work spills into the practice. This is a competition we just won for a coastal housing complex of 3,500 units in Tsingtao in China. We're just about to embark on this project, and some of these ideas are now being applied to real-life project. But I continue to maintain, and I guess this is a long way from habitat, basic naivety, that the problem was one of a building type, that we cannot transform the city until we radically change its fundamental transportation systems. Every change in urban growth and development occurred together with a change in transportation, when you think about it. 10 years ago, I wrote City After the Automobile, slightly misleading title, because it basically put forward the proposition that we will not give up the mobility of the private automobile voluntarily. It just gives us too much freedom and flexibility. But if that's the case, let's learn how to redeploy it so it would lend itself better to the problem we have in the city, which is first congestion, and secondly the inability to transfer from one mode of transportation to the other in a seamless way. That is between public transportation, whether it's a train or an aircraft, and the car, etc. So in the fellowship that we have in the office this year, we're looking at how to create on-demand mobility in the city and to try and assess what could it mean to urban development if we would accept, as, for example, the Paris and Montreal bicycle system on demand. You pick up a bicycle when you need it, you leave it when you don't, and you pay as you go. Extend this to automobiles so that most of us cease to own them but use them as we need them on demand. After I wrote the book, don't know if it was influenced by it, Zipcar emerged as an idea of communally owned cars. This is Zipcar in Vancouver. I don't have shares and I'm not promoting, but that's where you can pick up a Zipcar in Vancouver, and that is now emerging in many cities so that there is the beginning of a communally owned vehicle. Now, what happens when you don't own the vehicle is actually quite dramatic. You have here the parking lot compared to the kind of compactness where you can store cars when you are not required to retrieve a particular vehicle, but simply stack them until you need them on demand. And the reduction in space is dramatic. Once you can do that, and there are also many studies how to make the vehicles more compact, and it goes without saying that then they can be electric because you can charge them while you store them, you can start designing very efficient little places for storing these automobiles in a hospital, on a campus, in a district, in a neighborhood, and have them available on demand. The most dramatic change, you can start making transfers from a segment of a trip you do by mass transit, use the car when you need it, and make that transition. Same in an airport. Think of airports when you don't have to actually leave vehicles there and store them for a day or two or a week, but actually they are constantly circulating because they are not privately owned. So this kind of, all of a sudden, got us all excited. Because if you think about the physical experience of cities today, it's about being between cars. You walk in the street, there's cars parked all over the place. You cross, you enter a building, you walk through a parking lot. Worse, you go into a larger complex and you're in a garage, in the basement, etc. You experience the darkness, getting lost, finding your elevator, etc., etc. It's actually so much part of our physical world that we kind of take it for granted. But all of that, seeing them, other than when they're moving, can be gone. So this can become that, and so on and so forth. And this becomes that, and you can speculate what will happen then. So some people are worried, where will I keep my tapes in the automobile, and how will I keep my coffee mug, and so on and so forth. But maybe we can give that up. I want to talk about places for community at more the urban scale and the building scale. I want to share with you a project which I toiled on since 1972, which is over 35 years. It is an area in Jerusalem, the Mamilla area, which is basically the area which connects the old city and the new city, the Palestinian part of town with the Israeli part of town. It's the Mamilla area, which you see right there, 25 acres in what used to be the no man's land or the border area, and became, in the 90 years of division of the city, a very bad slum. And then in 72, the government expropriated that land and asked us to develop a master plan. And I saw this as an opportunity to create a bridge between the communities in the city and to create a public space that would draw and connect from all directions. This is Jaffa Gate. There is here a large parking terminal for the old city, which is a pedestrian area. There is an extension of the bazaars of the old city markets that goes right through and connects to downtown. There's residential development and hotels on that side, and mixed-use development on the other. It took almost 40 years to realize the project, which has just been completed, because it's Jerusalem, and there were controversies. First, the conservationists who felt you should not develop anything next to the old city because it should stay open, and this was an affront on the historic area. You could not create a contemporary development that's compatible with the old development. And then there were controversies over archaeology, which we discovered and preserved. Then there were controversies with the religious Orthodox community who felt there should be no shops near the old city and certainly no cinemas. That took 7 years. Eventually, and then there were, of course, developers who took the project on, and then the Intifada arrived. So they chickened out. And finally, a developer took the project on, and it is now open in the sense that its main pedestrian street has opened to the public with its shops and entertainment. It connects to the old city through the Jaffa Gate, and nothing has given me more joy than to see the entire cross-section of the population of Jerusalem, Palestinians, Israelis, Muslims, Christians, Jews, Orthodox, secular, they're all there together, and they're partaking in urban life. I thought they were. Oops, okay. There was a good picture there. Changing scale, I guess mega scale. 3.5 years ago, we were asked to design a complex which was an international competition for developers with the architects for what they call an integrated resort in downtown Singapore. The site is a downtown landfill area, which you see right there, part of the landfill that has come all the way around from the downtown basin. And the program, rather complex, 6 million net square feet, 10 million gross square feet of hotels, convention center, shopping, 2 theaters, a museum, a cultural facility, etc., etc. Our developer with our plan won the competition. The terms of reference for the competition were established by the Singapore Urban Redevelopment Authority, and they did something that we never do either in the United States or in Canada these days. They fixed the price of the land. And they said, we will select the best project in which, in terms of design, amenities, and what it contributes to the city and its culture, that will be the criteria, not the price of the land, based on which this project was selected. One of their criteria was that we give we create this promenade, which is part of the surround of the bay, which they have been committed to developing and connecting with the rest of the city, and many, many other criteria of what they felt was critical in terms of public urban life. For inspiration, I went back to thinking of Jerusalem and its famous Madaba plan, which is Byzantine Jerusalem, with a mosaic showing the Cardo Maximus cutting right through the city as the spine of urban life, with the understanding that every Roman city and every Greek city, for that matter, had this spine of life into which various components of the city plugged in. And so that became emerging. This was the promenade. This was our own urban spine, with its view corridors connecting to the subway, and all these merged together to become one urban place, so that in plan you have this spine with theaters, casino, convention center, hotels, and the Museum of Art Science all plugging in to the public domain. And in cross-section you could see how the retail, the waterfront promenade, the internal air-conditioned promenade, the sky promenade, something we created on top, all extend right through as public places. And so to give you a sense of the layering of public space, and there is this migration of indoor-outdoor. In Singapore, this is not a seasonal migration, but a daily migration. Nighttime, you want to be outside. Daytime, you want to be in air conditioning. So we begin with the outdoor promenade that runs along the water, and then we enter into the climate control promenade, which is an extension of that space with several levels of shopping, the cross corridors with their canals going right back into the water. And this is the infrastructure of public life, this grand structure that creates shade and enclosure and various levels as kind of a new kind of street with an event piazza, which they asked for, that could accommodate 20,000 people for public events and national events, which we proposed. This was a competition. Everybody was excited. Let's give them everything they want. A hydraulically controlled up and down piazza that can be transformed from a stepping amphitheater to a flat piazza. Little did we know what we're getting into. I summed up the idea in this sketch, which was about this sort of hanging gardens or stepping gardens of Singapore. The promenade, the inner street, the promenade on the roof of the podium building that extends the length of the building, and then on top of the hotels, three towers spanning across what we called the Sky Park. I don't know why this is green and purple, but must be an electronic. But that's good. So there it is, 2.5 acres, cantilevering 200 feet across, swimming pools, jogging paths, etc. And you see here an early sketch of the Sky Park, which is kind of makes it a great resort, and the final form as it evolved, with the entire cantilevered end being a public observatory and open to the public at large, the other part from here on being part of the hotel with its swimming pools and restaurants. And somehow as it evolved, taking on a marine quality. The 380 Airbus is that length, and Eiffel Tower on its side is that length. So it's big. The entire east facade, we propose, should be completely covered with bougainvilleas, 55 stories of them, our green wall. And the hotels themselves are interconnected by these series of atria that form yet another spine of public space, open to the public at large. The Art Science Museum was a response to a requirement that on the promontory site there would be a cultural facility. And since Singapore seemed to have everything already, concert hall and theater and aquarium, I invented something new, a museum of art science, one word, bringing the arts and the sciences together in one museum, which seems to relate to the theme of the institute, maybe. Why is that doing this? Cross-section through the museum with galleries above and below, and that great dish collecting the rainwater, which comes through the center of the building into a reservoir. We did that at Ben-Gurion Airport a few years earlier. There we got 8,000 gallons a minute on a good rainfall coming in through the building and collecting and being reused. One of the issues was to take this complex form and make it buildable and evolving its mathematics so that it has a rigorous, repetitive structure. These are the diagrams of a spheroid that became the generative geometry with slightly tweaked radii for each one of the fingers of the structure, which has already gotten all kinds of nicknames. Some call it the lotus, some call it the hands of welcome, and the more the merrier. I hope we're not going to see a lot of this red stuff. Well, there it is, about to open in April. And that's 3.5 years since we began the design. I don't think we could do this in North America. You see the towers rising, the podium, the art science on the promontory, the infrastructure, the containers of the public thoroughfare, the street coming up, the glass wall towards the west, and the atria spaces of the hotel as you move through them. And I can report that seeing it getting built, apart from the process itself, 13,000 workers in two shifts, which sounds archaeological, actually, that there is kind of a new urban scale here. There's a new sense of public place that I've never experienced yet. And it's very exciting to see this emerge. And I guess we would need to wait and see how this works in terms of public life in the city as the project opens later next year. Moving further down in scale, my favorite building type, libraries. And I want to talk about libraries, specifically about the role that they play in community life and how a design attempts to respond to that. And the reason I love libraries as a building type is that there is this kind of rich tradition of what a library is all about. First of all, the Library of Alexandria, that we will forever be curious about in our fantasies. This is Ephesus, of course, and the great 19th century libraries, La Brouste in Paris, the Bibliothèque Nationale, and the fantasy libraries. These are illustrations for Borges's fantastic library. I didn't see that when I designed the Vancouver Public Library, but it's kind of neat. And I think that just briefly touching on the public library square, is to remember that in all the heat of debate whether gladiators actually fought and died on that site in the past or not, what was missed is the program written by the library team before they announced the competition was a very radical document about the meaning of library to public life. The program talked about creating a place of community that's open 18 to 24 hours a day, that draws the community at large and transcends the traditional function of library. That was true radical thinking. We understood it as we began working on the building. And I think the urban room, as it came to be known, and the term that's now kind of been coined, is that expression of the public place that goes beyond. And of course, the public roof garden that never became public, but there is hope. Hold, don't give up. Now, the Vancouver experience was not lost on other libraries. And when the Salt Lake Public Library project was announced, they had come to Vancouver, and they wrote a program very much influenced and in the spirit of the Vancouver program. Again, there was a competition. There were five firms. We were one of them. And I was amazed that this notion of the urban room and the transformation of the library beyond its traditional program did not actually have much impact on the other submissions. But here was a unique site which abutted City Hall, freestanding Richardsonian building in its park, and the old library would be, this is old library being transformed to other public use, but the program called for an urban room, but also for a large public piazza that would create life in downtown Salt Lake. And downtown Salt Lake is not downtown Vancouver. Downtown Salt Lake at 5 o'clock is desolate. In Vancouver, one can rely on you know, a vibrant urban life. Here, they had built a light rail that connects the university to downtown with a stop right next to the library. So many moves were being made to try and create this. But how do you create an indoor and an outdoor public place that really kind of become active and public in an American city that has no tradition of public life in the downtown whatsoever? At best, you can go to the mall and you know, there's just that very limited kind of life of a mall. So here is a diagram we made, which said, you got to have a space that moves seasonally, indoors, outdoors. So, you know, winter and very hot summer days, you're in air conditioning, but it emerges outdoors into this grand piazza. This urban wall contains shops, cinemas, auditoria, etc. And the roof will be a public reading garden. And they had guts. They went for it. So I can't help say that. But here's that wall. This is the urban room, and it spills out into the outdoor piazzas, auditoria, cinemas, and so on, and the library itself with its reader galleries surrounding the basic form, and in that sense very much taking on the diagram of the Vancouver Public Library. And then there were these usual debates, because we said that this wall would be a crescent wall that inclines and descends so that the public could go up to the park and down from the park without going into the library, make it truly public. And they said, give us a precedent. Who's going to climb up there? So that's from the China trip. Well, it gets used and climbed on. This is the urban room, surrounded by reading galleries, looking down into... And I am fascinated by the kind of activities that go on in that space. There are these kind of massive gatherings. They're formal dinners. This is the lens looking to the... We call it the lens. It's a great window looking to the Wabash Mountains, but it faces south. How do you make in a desert city a glass wall facing south, which you see very transparent at night? And we did that by creating this double glass wall, collecting the energy at winter and bringing it into the building and rejecting it or ventilating it out of the building at summer, with the children's library at the bottom with its own kind of self-shading system, which you see there. And so the children themselves can create their own environment by drawing the shades. The story reading room by the artist Karl Schlaminger. The roof garden, very popular spot. People like getting married there for some reason. And the people climbing. And the kinds of celebrations, concerts, events, art fairs, mountain climbing. And we made it into Archie. So this is the world famous Salt Lake Library. It's awesome. Wow, it's double wow. Throw a triple wow for me.
What else does an architect want? I want to shift to a site which is really set in nature. This is the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, being built by the Walton family of Walmart fame in downtown Bentonville. Don't be misled by the word downtown, but downtown Bentonville. On the family estate, which is a beautiful treed ravine extending from the downtown. And this is building with nature, in nature. My sense was that we should not build on the hilltops, which have amazing mature trees and pines, but actually build within the ravine. And I had the notion that there's a spring there, we would dam the ravine so we would create two ponds, and that would become the center of the museum, which would also be a community center. And so by creating these two dams, two ponds, 4 meters apart were formed. So here is the museum as it emerges, the two ponds, the arrival from the top, descending, galleries wrapping around, sort of a communal space forming one bridge across the water, both a dam and a bridge, galleries coming around, a great hall for events and the curatorial wing. The entire project is being built with wood harvested in Arkansas, laminated beams, skylights, of course, light the various galleries. The structure itself is a tent-like cable, suspension cable that supports the wood beams, with the galleries forming spaces within that. And I would say that it is about experiencing art and community life in nature, being aware of nature as you're experiencing the art, and vice versa. That sense of indoor and outdoor, a sense of an oasis within the city. This project is well into construction and should open in about a year. So we're going to shift pace a bit, or at least theme, and I want to talk about three projects which are symbolically charged and how one has dealt with the kind of issues that go well beyond just shelter. And I'd like to begin with the Children's Memorial at Yad Vashem, which I actually designed in 1976. But, as you will see, did not get built for many years. The assignment was to create a museum, a memorial museum to the children who died in the Holocaust in Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. And at the time, I felt, having spent weeks in their archives and seeing objects and drawings and letters and other, you know, extremely deeply troubling objects, that you could not create an informative museum after the public has emerged from the historic museum, which is filled with information, and get more information. So I made a counter proposal to enter under this natural cave on the site into an underground chamber, and that you would come into an anteroom that had a few photographs of children who perished in the Holocaust. And then you would move forward into a space which had a single candle in its center. And by optical effects of mirror walls and semi-reflective walls, that candle would reflect into infinity millions of times. And you would move through these lights as you heard a voice reading the names, ages, and birthplace of the children. And that voice goes on and on without repeating many, many weeks. It turned out that the Yad Vashem board thought that this was inappropriate, that people would misunderstand and think that it is maybe like a discotheque, so they shelved it. And then in 1986, 10 years later, a survivor who lost his two-year-old son with his wife arrived. They lost their two-year-old son in Auschwitz, saw the model that was still there with its optical effects, and as things happened, wrote a check and said, build it, and so it was built. As you emerge from the candlelit space, you come out to light again and to the hills of Jerusalem. About 10 years ago, while I was on my commute to Jerusalem, I had a call from the foreign ministry who said the chief minister of the Punjab, who was on a state visit, was taken to Yad Vashem, as heads of state always are, and he was taken to the Children's Memorial, and he was very moved and asked to meet the architect. Was I available to meet with him? I went down to Tel Aviv and met him at his hotel, Chief Minister Badal, and he said to me, we Sikhs have had a great history of suffering and martyrdom, and we are about to build our national museum to tell our story. This has deeply moved me. I want you to come and do it. Just like that. No competitions, no interview. And 2 weeks later, I was in the Punjab. They first took me to see the Golden Temple, the holiest place for the Sikhs. They reminded me that the museum is to be a secular place. This is the sacred, holy place for the Sikhs. And then I was taken to this town outside Chandigarh, Anandpur Sahib, which is the place where the last guru who wrote the Khalsa, the scripture of the Sikhs, died and in his fortress, being the last guru in the series of 10 gurus. The great temple in the town is down there with the fortress, and they took me to a site down 9 kilometers away from town and said, there's our site. There were flags, and we were in a convoy, and I was bewildered. I mean, this place gets 500,000 people on the festivals. How are they going to come with their trains and buses and trucks and whatever 9 kilometers away from town? It turned out that the chief priest owned the land. But I suggested we go back into town, get rid of the cars, and anything that's walking distance away was legitimate. So we came back here, and we started walking down into this valley, and I said, oh, these hills look good. Who owns them? What can we do? And being India and due process, 2 weeks later, they were purchased. And so these were the early sketches. There's these sand cliffs on the site, and there's the fortress not far from it. This was a sketch done from memory of the fortress town of Jaisalmer in the Rajasthan. And here I was thinking in terms of how the building will rise also out of the dunes and sort of evoke the sense of fortress of Punjabi architecture. And so this was the model I brought back, proposing that the valley be dammed into a series of water gardens. On the town side, we would have auditorium, a library, and changing exhibitions. And on the other, we would have the historic museum that would tell the whole story of Sikh history. And there was a lot of fuss and debate about what did the chief minister do importing an architect, and what would a Canadian Israeli Jew know about Sikhism, as it said in the newspaper. But this model seemed to kind of diffuse the discussion. And then I went away and we started doing drawings, came back for a visit, and they'd taken the model and made it 10 times bigger, as you see here. And we're still drawing, and I came back, but they built the bridge. And then there was a groundbreaking, and 500,000 people showed up. We're going to open November 2nd, 10 years later, with exhibits. And here it is before completion, but getting there. Stainless steel roofs reflect the light back towards the Gurdwara, the temple. It's a concrete structure covered with Gawalir sandstone. The galleries of the permanent exhibits as you move through two levels, and the roofs as they reach up and merge into the sky. Skylights which light the galleries below. All this will be gardens, restaurant by the water, and the kind of rising of the building out of the sand cliffs. There's a symbol of Sikhism which is called the Khanda, which is a sword. Some of the more traditional people wanted a great big sword in the middle of the site. I said, I'll give you one in the building. Maybe you can give up the other one. Sort of got by. So back to Yad Vashem, because this happened in that sequence. As this was getting built, Yad Vashem decided to rebuild completely the historic museum. And it decided to do so for several reasons. First, the exhibit was completely obsolete. There was enormous amount of information become available after the Soviet Union demise. The Holocaust Museum in Washington was much more comprehensive. And also they went from a museum that dealt with 300,000 people a year to 3 million a year and rising. And so this is the site of the old museum, the beautiful pastoral hill. And again, unlike the Punjabis who gave the project, this was a competition again. Nothing easy. And there was an international competition in three phases, which we won. And this was one of my first sketches, which is I felt I did not want to build on that hill. I wanted to keep it in its pastoral. And this was a large addition, I mean, new construction of 40,000 square feet. And so these were speculations how to cut through the mountain and build a building that comes from one end of the mountain and cuts right through to the other side. So in you come and out you emerge with the entire museum being underground. This was the first idea that sort of evolved further and further. And actually it made more sense the deeper I got into it, because you come in at a low level through this reception building and you cross over a bridge and you enter the museum at this end. The entire galleries are under the mountain, and then you emerge to light at the end, and then backtrack through the old memorial to the children's memorial and back out. And you see here the sequence of arrival, entry, and then cuts through the floor force you through that prism to move from one chapter to the other, so that the narrative is imposed on the visitor in a sequence as you move through. So, gateway into the site, reception building with the various public services, the light soft and diffused coming through and kind of dematerializing everything as you enter. And then one of the things I decided very early in the process is that though the zoning in Jerusalem requires all building to be done with golden Jerusalem limestone, I wanted an exception here. I felt that stone was too pretty, and I wanted a building that had no sense of traditional building, that it was only concrete, the floors, the walls, only concrete and skylights, but no other material. And I got a dispensation not to use stone, and as you see, it's all made out of beautifully crafted concrete. And then crossing the bridge and entering this structure 18 meters high that cuts through the mountain with light coming from above. And then as you move forward, you are stopped by these cuts in the floor with exhibits in them. These are the books from the burning of the books in Berlin. And then you are shifted sideways into the galleries, chapter by chapter. And always light coming from above, and the floor is sloping gently downwards, so you're getting deeper and deeper into the mountain as the skylights are getting further and further away. And then there is the Hall of Names, which is the last episode in the sequence, where the files containing testimonies of 3 million victims are stored in this perimeter, and I propose then a cut into the earth as a kind of a memory of the 3 million names that will never be known. And so here you come upon that space, you see the actual files in the perimeter, you enter, upwards you see photographs mounted on this cone taken from these files, daylight coming from above, and into the earth, down to the water table, is that carving in the rock with the faces from above reflecting in the groundwater. But then was a question of what happens after that. And this, I felt, was the architect's contribution. And I proposed that the building burst out, literally explode, towards the north and towards light, as a reaffirmation that life prevailed, we prevailed, and there is, you know, life ahead. Very controversial move, took 6 months to convince the committee that it was appropriate. And also the bold architectural expression of these walls coming out and overhanging the mountain with a forestation under it as a sort of symbol of renewal. The post-tensioning cables that hold this cantilever back and make that structure possible. And I will conclude in a final project, which again is symbolically charged, although in a very different way. This is the headquarters of the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, on the National Mall, facing the Lincoln and Vietnam memorials. Now, I do a survey in the United States when I speak, and I say, how many people in the room here have heard about the United States Institute of Peace? How many here? One, two, three, four, five, six. In the United States, you'd get four. It's amazing because the United States Institute of Peace was created by Congress 25 years ago to sort of be a little balancing act to the Pentagon. Conflict resolution and peace and peace pursuit is their mandate. They now will have a site that probably will make them better known because it's a very, as you can see, very prominent site at the entrance to the city, right by the various monuments on the Mall. This too was a competition, and to me the question was, is how do you find a way to make a building that is a symbol for peace? Much more abstract and complex a notion. And this, just to understand the relationships, Lincoln, Jefferson is over there, the Vietnam Memorial is, of course, dug in the earth, but it's there. And, of course, the State Department is overlooking us all. And there's the Peace Institute. And so I started thinking in terms of, there's a series of atria, that two atria that sort of are the basic plan of the building, one facing the Potomac and one facing Lincoln, a series of light, transparent, translucent, floating roofs, a sense of whiteness and lightness. There's the plan, and there are some of the sketches relating it back to the Jefferson Memorial, a series of domes, so to speak, spherical sections they ended up being, but not solid, made of glass, white glass, and searching for geometry, and eventually ending up with a spherical geometry that would feel like a solid series of domes, almost like in flight during the day, and would glow at night as the light comes from within the building, as seen from the Lincoln Memorial. So, under construction and opening soon, there's the inevitable State Department. We're looking from direction of the Lincoln Memorial. And you see here the Washington Monument and those roofs floating over and beginning to receive their white glass. And so, a couple of words in conclusion. I'm often asked what really inspires me as an architect. And I would say that the thing that inspires me most is studying nature's ways. This really resonates with one of the things that Arthur wrote about nature, that in appreciating design and nature, both organic and inorganic, one learns about fitness. One learns about evolution. One learns in the Darwinian sense about the concept of fitness. And fitness in the sense that something that so resonates with its purpose, in which we feel an inevitability. And to me, that quality in architecture, that there is a sense of inevitability, which is another way of putting it, is that you have a sense of timelessness, that it's not something that's faddy of the moment, but something that will have meaning in time, is the litmus test. And there is a connection between beauty and fitness in my mind, that beauty is the manifestation of that kind of fitness. And so in many ways, it seems to me that beauty as a concept is the quest for getting the sense of fitness in architecture. Now, this notion of beauty is not unique to the arts. Mathematicians love to talk about beauty. Hardy talking about mathematics. Beauty is the first test. There is no permanent place in the world for ugly mathematics. And the morphologist, Andrea Cook, speaking about form generally, talks about beauty connotes humanity. We call a natural object beautiful because we see that its form expresses fitness, the perfect fulfillment of function in the lines of structure. And I'd like to end with the words of Arthur Erickson. Beauty, a word much avoided in this late mechanistic era, conveys an inexplicable sense of harmony and wholeness. A thing of beauty is not pretty, not perfect, nor flashy, but restrained, often odd, tough, indefinable. It touches a higher sense than the emotions alone. Thank you very much.
Mr. Safdie will now take questions from the audience. He's asked to handle them himself, so I'll turn the podium back over to him.
Thank you. Yes.
When you talked here a long time ago, you showed a set of wooden models, and you said at the time that you wished you could build something that had the same beauty of the wood as those models. Have you ever been able to do that?
Trying to remember the models. Do you remember what project they were?
Yeah, it was for the models for the Colosseum.
Ah, the cherry wood model. Don't you think the building is better than the model?
You said at the time you loved looking at these models. You had about 15 of them. Yeah,
I'm satisfied with the building now. I have no complaints. In fact, I was there yesterday, and it was just a pleasure to see how packed it was and how well-worn.
You give me your thoughts on coexisting the megascale development in the city's heritage preservation and restoration, and if it's somewhat homogenous, the megascale development, will it destroy the food uniqueness, or is there an opportunity to actually further uniqueness to megascale?
I'm not sure. I'll repeat, but I need to understand first. So what is the question, whether megascale development in a historic city could erase the historic heritage? Is that the question? Well, I think historic cities have a much tougher time than cities which are kind of essentially new, because there is the issue of transition and the relationship between 19th or 18th or 17th century scale and 21st century scale. And so often it raises a question of where should development take place? In Paris, for example, there was a school that said Paris II, don't touch historic Paris, don't build anything there of any scale, do it in a new Paris at enough distance that you don't clash. And I got caught in that argument in Manila because people didn't trust the scale that I was proposing would be harmonious with the old city. That's why they didn't want anything there. They felt, well, 8, 9 stories, that, you know, that's going to be out of sync. And actually, in Jerusalem,